Welcome to the More Than Birds podcast, where we talk about more than birds. Today we're here with Force Roland, who works for Rock Jumper Worldwide. And Force, what do you do for Rock Jumper?
Well, I guess among other things, I'm the New World Operations Manager, and I lead a lot of tours through the New World. I do a little bit in the Old World too, but just when time permits, really. So mostly setting up logistics and guiding a lot of the trips to the New World.
Oh, great. And how long have you been with Rock Jumper?
Oh, only about 2 years now. About okay. 2 years ago, they picked me up. I got an email while I was working on the Pribilof Islands in Alaska, inviting me to the post. And I had known some of the guys from before. Great guys, and I kind of jumped at the opportunity. So
all right, that brings it up because have a certain love affair with Attu and the Pribilofs. You got to tell me, what were you doing on the Pribilofs, and how is it being on the Pribilofs?
Well, I was guiding out there, and I was helping out with some of the bird surveys and with the St. Paul Island Tour Companies, which is, you know, sort of the ground agent for all of the tourists who come, whether it's general photography and, of course, you know, birds and birding, which a lot of the guests were, especially during, you know, peak migration times, like mid-May when we opened up until about June 15th, it was almost all birders. And then the photographers came because that's when the chicks are coming and all the puffins are flying in with, you know, their bills full of food. And so, yeah, it sort of differed from time to time. And then late migration season in September, when I left to pick up a guiding position in Ecuador for Rock Jumper there, we were starting to get more birders coming back for the fall vagrant season, which was pretty huge and always very exciting.
And how many seasons were you on the Pribilofs?
I just did the one. I was there from – yep. And there were originally, you know, it's sort of a three to four man operation. And there were three of us working originally. But by the end of May, I found myself alone. So it was a long season, but it was a great season. I had a lot of fun, and I called in for reinforcements in August. So that was great.
And was it a good year in the Pribilofs when you were out there, or how did it go?
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, it was really good. I think the best year in overall diversity. So including like North American migrants and Asian migrants and vagrants coming over, it was the best. Had a lot of really exciting birds, and it was great. No, you know, none of these sort of megas that people talk about, but I say that Pacific Swift, Siberian Flycatcher, and a common house martin, all these things. Those were all really nice. So we did well. It was a good year.
So you're in the Pribilofs. You get a call that you're going to be a guide for Rock Jumper in Ecuador.
Mm-hmm,
What was your experience with the Neotropics before that?
I only recently moved to the States. Well, relatively recently, in 2007, I moved back. I had lived in Ecuador for almost 6 years, and so I had done a little bit of research and quite a bit of guiding in Ecuador, Peru, and Colombia. A lot of private stuff, you know, the 3 years before I moved back to the States, and then I kind of kept that up from 2007 until I was hired by Rock Jumper as well, doing private trips throughout the Neotropics on sort of a gig by gig basis, and doing a bunch of research here in the States in the interim, working for the Bureau of Reclamation, Great Basin Bird Observatory, Rocky Mountain Bird Observatory, Montana Natural Heritage, and the Wildlife Diversity Program here, which is how I ended up here in Montana. Mm-hmm. So yeah, kind of a pretty diverse deal, but I think through my experience in the Neotropics in Ecuador and sort of living there, and Rock Jumper wanting to establish a bigger presence there and have a greater repertoire in sort of the Neotropic area in general, because they were already doing Antarctic and whatnot. They brought me on. They wanted me to help expand there.
Oh, that's great. And so you had the experience in Ecuador, and what's mm-hmm. been the expansion of your tours in Latin America since?
Well, basically, we've added just this year alone, because I kind of came in on 2012, kind of mid-year, and our schedule for that year's, you know, as you are being familiar with the system, you know, is already pretty much set up. But for 2013 alone, I added another seven tours to the New World and a UAE and Oman tour as well. And so brought eight new tours to the table, and then we've got three more going next year, four more going next year, actually, that are new. And so a lot of good stuff going on. It's fun. I think we all like the planning and to see, you know, how it sort of evolves. And then the end result, you know, when you get the client feedback at the end of the tour and just see, you know, kind of how it went. It's all very exciting and adventurous.
Yeah, you get feedback of how many times you got the van stuck in the mud, yeah. How many times you missed dinner.
That's right. That's
I'm speaking from experience on that.
Absolutely.
But, so you were in Ecuador for all this time. What brought you initially down to Ecuador?
Well, I was in Oman visiting my father and his family at the time. And I met an Ecuadorian family there, and they mentioned a research station that was kind of, you know, open and in need of some help. And they sort of allowed people to come and do their research, you know, for a small fee. And so I jumped on that. I got affiliated with the university there in Ecuador, and they invited me out to the research station. So I was at the research station for a while. And then, you know, kind of going back and forth between Quito and there, taking research oriented classes and whatnot at the university that this research station was affiliated with. And it's sort of evolved. I guess one day, probably at my favorite pizza joint, I ran into a fellow that had done a very similar thing and was guiding at Sacha Lodge and La Selva and some of the other sort of Amazon-based lodges there. And that was sort of the beginning of my guiding, I guess. Yeah, I started doing that. I started guiding at the various lodges that are in the Amazonian part of Ecuador, and then it evolved very rapidly from there. So,
and what was your research?
Mostly on ant birds, on ant bird constituent flocks. And so it was basically on because some of the ant birds will follow only specifically one or two different species of ants. And so there was a big myrmecological sort of side to it. But others will break off and say if a termite nest is moving, certain ant birds will follow those as well, but others will not. And one of the questions was, you know, why, how do they divide up these territories, these roving territories and whatnot, as well as the typical army ant motion goes through. So that was basically what I was interested in and working on. And, you know, truth be told, I guess when I started guiding and whatnot, I let it kind of go by the wayside because I really found something that, I don't know, I really enjoyed the people aspect of it. And I guess, you know, spending months in the remote Amazon will do that to you sometimes.
Following ants.
People, yeah, that's right.
And so you were down in the Amazon. Now, did you have any experience in Latin America at all before you came to Oman? I mean, did you speak Spanish already or?
Didn't speak much Spanish. I was in Mexico for, you know, maybe about a year on and off before that and spoke a little bit of Spanish, but everyone in Mexico was so excited to learn English and to practice English that I couldn't get anybody to speak Spanish to me. And so I took half a year in high school when I was a sophomore, you know, as everybody does, you know, kind of what you're expected to do. And that was it. And so when I went to Ecuador, I had to learn on the fly. And I think, boy, yeah, immersion in a remote situation really, you know, teaches you how to catch up, I think, on language skills, because you really, you know, you need them all the more quickly. So, yeah.
And so you were in Oman, you start working for Rock Jumper in Ecuador. Mm-hmm. So you guys have added, I assume, Peru tours and what other ones you kind of added?
Well, Northern Peru is a fairly new one. We had done sort of Central and Southern. We're going to do Paraguay next year, the Chaco region of Paraguay, which seems really exciting. We've had some people that have gone kind of on their own and talked about that. I'm going to be going down to Bolivia in May, which I've not done much of. I've just done sort of the northern, you know, mountainous part, not even montane, but Altiplano, the highlands. So that'll be sort of a new area for us as well. So I'll be going down and scouting that out for a couple of weeks. But then on top of that, we've sort of expanded in Central America. We're doing more in Belize, Honduras. We're now doing, you know, Guatemala really regularly, Costa Rica, all these sorts of things. Where as before, it was sort of just Northern Ecuador and some Colombia. You know, the big one this year that we actually, gosh, within about a month of conceiving and putting it on paper and getting on the website, we booked out our first offering for it, and we're having to schedule two more. Quick on its heels is this Colombia Mega. And so we decided that we're going to try and go for 1,000 species in a month in Colombia, which is, you know, it's feasible. Hard, but feasible.
A thousand in a month.
Yeah. Yeah. I did. My personal best was 23 days was 793. And it was, yeah, it was the smallest individual person's list. There was one gentleman who couldn't walk too far from the vehicle. He still ended up with 715 or so in 23 days. So it is feasible. And that wasn't doing any of the Eastern Andes, the Eastern Andean slope or the Amazon. That was just doing, you know, Magdalena Valley, the slope, Central Andes, Western Andes, and Santa Marta.
So you never went over the proverbial hill and went down the other side?
No. We just did the Western Andes inside, now Cauca Valley, Magdalena Valley, Central Andes, and then flew up near the Caribbean coast in Santa Marta. And, you know, we figured once we came back with that total, Adam especially, the company's owner, just jumped on it and said, "Hey, this looks like we could maybe do something kind of big here. So we're gonna give it our shot. Our first one's this winter."
And so these people book for approximately a 30-day tour?
Yeah, it's a little bit less than that. Yeah, but it's a little over 3 weeks.
How the hell do you keep from not being run ragged?
I think pacing does get to be the hard part, especially in the neotropics. I mean, I don't know how much what your experience down there is with sort of Ecuador and some of these places.
Just Central America. I haven't been to South America yet.
Okay, well, Central is definitely a good dose of it, but you know the species list at any one place is endless. I mean, you could be out all day and all night, every day and every night, not possibly see everything. And so, pacing really is a big deal, and it's sort of, I think that's where people skills come into play too, because you have to sort of, you know, get people to realize that you can go full tilt for 15 days, but then you're going to crash. You know, they're going to crash. You know, it gets a little tough after that. So you just try and go for, you know, you work out mentally all the target birds and what you want to see in each area. And if one is seen in three places, but it's much easier in one than the other two, then you go for the other birds at those other two that you're not going to see at the one. Right. And so it's a bit of a juggling act, but it's sort of to allow people a little bit of time after lunch to breathe and a relatively, you know, good night's sleep.
Good night's sleep.
Yeah.
Because I know, like, when I've led trips, I've done 14-day trips, and people are just pooped. I mean, they're done.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that sort of that little time after lunch, I mean, there's here and there I try and sneak in some sanity hours, you know, because on 14 days, you know, on a 14-day trip, it gets long if you're going full tilt. But, you know, most people can kind of, you know, they can make it 10 days, maybe 12 days into the 14, 15. But yeah, 21 plus days, nobody's gonna make it that long without a little bit of a little bit of time to read a book, think about something else, sort of, you know, put all of these hundreds and hundreds of birds and things they've seen, because it's all this, you know, landscape, new food, you know, just a million other things that go into your mind, I suppose, that sort of make it, you know, good to have a little bit of time to think.
And how do you address travel sickness?
Travel sickness. Wow, that's one reason I love Ecuador, is because it's never been an issue. But yeah, you know, I usually tell people to go ahead and bring Cipro and just be, you know, kind of prepared that you might have one or two down days. But, you know, and I think the hardest part is mentally people get really down on themselves. They get really hard on the time that they've missed, but they shouldn't. I mean, it's natural. Your body goes through changes. It's just different flora and fauna. And what are you going to do, really? You just got to kind of work your way through it. But, you know, if you miss a day or two, just rest hard, rest well. And then on that third day, get out there and get back to it. You just, you know, got to kind of try and rest up as best you can. But that is always the tough one, you know, and everyone always asks about that. And all the health concerns that come with, you know, a full month being exposed to different water, different cuisine, you know, and in a very wide range of accommodations. You know, you get to Colombia, some of the rural places are great. You're shocked by this lovely sort of estate-like lodge that you get to. And in others, it's about what you expect.
Right.
It can be varied for sure.
And, you know, you have these clients, they pay for this. And are you using local fixers and local guides in conjunction with you? We are.
There are a few tours that I'll do on my own in Ecuador, and it's usually private tours. A lot of times if people come with 4 to 6 people, again, it's more cost efficient if they only have one guide. And I know the site so well that, you know, a local guide isn't really necessary. But what I'll do is I'll get the park guards incorporated. And it's really, you know, the reason we steer clear of that is pretty obvious. I mean, you really want to have a local influence. You want to help bolster the local economy as best you can. And really, you know, even further concrete just how valuable these preserves and lodges and these concerns can be for the local community. And this was something in Colombia that I felt was very, very interesting, and kind of the way they sent around, you know, this guy dressed up in a yellow-eared parrot costume to try and teach people, for example, to not cut down Romerillo palms for Palm Sunday. And these sorts of things that, you know, a lot of donations and a lot of the tourist income can help fund as long as the foundations are doing this. So we also try to focus on working with concerns and foundations that do have direct visible impacts. You can see exactly what's going on, the progress that is being made as well. And truth be told, most of them are that way. Hokus Oko Foundation in Ecuador, you know, Proaves and some of those in Colombia, there's quite a few in Colombia now that are just doing amazing things. I think the Armonia concern in Bolivia is another one too. So it's just kind of nice to work with those people. And, you know, we set aside a fair percent of, you know, our annual income. We have our own conservation concern with Rockjumper, but being, you know, South Africa.
That's great.
Yeah, we do. We take a fair, and it kind of depends from, you know, general offerings to private concerns. It varies between 8% and 15%, but all of that goes right into a conservation fund that is used for, you know, various research and management strategies, but it's mostly in Africa. And so in the New World, what we've tried to do is work directly in conjunction with foundations that can use the money and have a good track record.
And so are you finding that, you know, birding and the money that birding can bring, especially the more rural communities, are you starting to find a change of perception among the people of how they treat their natural resources? Because if it's gone, they realize they don't get that influx of cash anymore.
Definitely. I mean, I think the, you know, the hardest part is, you know, they're very, you know, historically there haven't been very many options, or there's not a perceived option. It is, you know, it's the Homesteaders Act. It still exists in Ecuador to this day, where if you clear, you know, 33 to, I think it's, I know, maybe I'm wrong, it might be 43-45% of 10 hectares, then you can call it your own. If you clear for agriculture. And so, you know, you have these sorts of things that are, I mean, even in the legislature that are working against you, basically. And so those are how people have sustained themselves and survived for so many generations that it's really hard to tell a young guy, 23, 3 kids, you know, that he needs to stop selling wood and he needs to come and work for this foundation of, you know, different thinking people. And so the big idea is to just make sure that they understand and become educated about viable options. And of course, education being the only really long-term endeavor that would last. You know, you come in with foreign money. A lot of times the capital is from various international concerns to purchase these lands and whatnot. And, you know, you really have to have a stable presence on the ground. And so you have to have local national representation and very, you know, heartfelt individuals that are donating all of their time to these concerns to be there. Because in the past, I think, you know, some of the failures that international conservation has met is through coming in, buying a bunch of land and then leaving and not explaining to all the people around what the value of this is. Because, you know, they might look at birds and they might like them, but again, you've got mouths to feed. You have a lot of things that go into it, but yeah.
And the local people, I especially know, like, you know, in Ecuador and, you know, the Eastern Amazon Basin with the oil companies coming in, and that being, and I think that, you know, especially as bird guides and birders, we're going to butt up against those competing concerns.
Sure.
Are the local people, discriminating, do you think, between, you know, the money they can get short term, but a lot of it from the oil company, and what they can get it on a sustainable, say, bird tours? And
yeah, I think a great example actually in Ecuador that I just recently visited. They revamped their lodge and we're now starting to take people there. I'll be there in a couple of weeks. Is Sani Lodge. it's a
I
lot
saw your pictures on Facebook from the last time.
It was a great trip, and it was really kind of wonderful to get to talk to a lot of the village elders and people with clout in the community, the San Isla community, who were dealing with the oil companies, and they were actually fending them off to the extent that the oil companies, you know, were basically kind of treating it like, we already own this land, you're just renting here and we'll give you this. But they brought the lawyers to bear. They've got some international funding and they're really fighting a good fight there. And so far winning. So what they're basically working out is that the oil company will have access to some land that is X amount of distance from the community, X amount of distance from the lodge and preservation area, and won't encroach, you know, a certain mitigation line and all sorts of, you know, little things that they're going through. But they're actually taking the time, and it's a really interesting thing, is they're taking the time to do this as a community and not entirely based on sort of foreign influence and knowledge. There is a real sense of, I think, community pride there. And so there certainly are, you know, the short-term thinkers that, you know, want the money, always will be. But it seems like the community thought at San Isla at the moment, in this particular example, is going to be beneficial to the forest and their ecotourism concerns in the long run. They've invested in, you know, getting good guides, new cabins. They have Wi-Fi. It was crazy. You know, you're out in the middle of the jungle and there's Wi-Fi, so they can run a tight ship. And I don't know. It's really kind of impressive, because this is one of the that's a fine example right there of where, you know, tourism and sort of a local community awareness have blended together and kind of helped each other keep an area intact, at least for the time being, for the foreseeable future.
And, you know, the other thing that I always think about when people have tour groups and they go to other parts of the world is, what effect do we have on a culture? You know, how are we changing that culture by merely being us?
Well, it's a long story. What's the best way to abbreviate it? There was a house that we used to take people to in a community close to Sacha Lodge, because people wanted to see how do the locals live? How do the, you know.
A typical Western thing, yeah.
They're so poor. Let's go and see it. And, you know, so that we would take people, we would oblige, hoping that they would come away with a certain, I guess, knowledge or truth about truth. That's a strong word. But anyways, a perception of how these people live and what they have and what we don't have that they do have, and in comparison to what we have and they don't. And it didn't work out. It actually ended in the family wanted. They saw these people with cameras, and they saw us coming down in a big motorboat, and they wanted boats, and they thought, well, we can charge people to come visit our house. And we thought, hey, it's an infraction on their time. Sure, we'll give them a small fee. And then they started making shikras and all these sort of neat sort of cultural goods and selling those at an inflated price. And long story short, they were basically excised from the local community because they ended up with a new boat, a new motor, and they didn't want to share any of the money with the community. And they pretty much were completely ostracized by their family, friends, everyone there. And it was basically because they were looking at what we had that, and they didn't, and they put a very different value on that than they put on, you know, the typical family ties and community spirit. And it's sort of that inherent interaction that I don't really know how you can handle that, because it's really just showing up. Like you said, it's, you know, what do we have by just being there? Well, by just being there, they're looking at something that's completely foreign. And, you know, as long as they have piped in satellite TV where they can see it, or if they can get internet once a week by taking a boat trip to Coca, the common perception is that you need that stuff. When actually, to me, I mean, they farmed like 5-6 hours a day. They went fishing the rest of the time. They hung out. They, you know, had community dances. They, you know, I don't know. They had a shorter life expectancy than we do. Right. But, you know, for a little bit of effort, they seem to have pretty rich lives in ways that we don't perceive. And we always come in there and just like, oh, well, I just want to give you $20. Well, what's $20 going to do them anyways? I mean, if somebody's $420 a whole year, it'll cost them $20 to get to town and back. And then what's he going to spend? He's going to spend what he'd been saving. So I don't know. It's a conundrum, but I guess, I guess stewardship and how to represent your people is sort of something that we should think about a little bit more, I guess, before invading some of these areas, because I think a lot of times we just go bowling in with our curiosity and ability and funds, and we don't really know what to do once we get there and what's going to happen when we leave. So it's always a bit of a conundrum.
Well, and that's what I've seen, you know, in some other areas, like, you know, the first time I went to Costa Rica, it seemed, there's a few gringos around, but, you know, it seemed fairly intact. And then the last time I went, just over the period of 10 years, It's absolutely amazing that there's a Four Seasons. There's a golf course, you know, every 20 miles along the coastlines. And I always say the problem with Costa Rica is us.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's changed. I mean, it changes the face of cultures. And I think, another place where I've seen a big influence on it is in the Middle East. I mean, especially the Sultanate of Oman, which I love. I really can't say enough good things about that place. And the people, too. They're just lovely. Every time I go there, I mean, I have a really kind of profound interaction with somebody. But Oman essentially had two telephones in the whole country in 1985. And then the oil comes in, and what happened was the Sultan's son, who's the current Sultan, Madnak Qaboos, he basically ran his father out of office and started, instead of hoarding these funds, which his father apparently literally did put money in his mattress because they were so poor before the oil came. And then the oil came, and it's like, oh my God, you know, it's no more living off of frankincense and camel meat. It's, it's real. We're actually expanding. Anyways, he put a road system in. He built hospitals, he built schools, he built universities, he gives scholarships. He's done a million wonderful things for the country. But one thing that he really took to heart was, I guess, about 10 or 12 years ago, somebody said, we need to really work on the tourism thing. And that's something that's happened there now, too. A lot of the old souks where you would be the only, you know, tourist in, and it would be, you know, very inexpensive and homey, very interesting, are now, you know, tourist destinations, just run over with tourists. There's whole areas where there were big cores and shorebird stopover sites that are completely leveled. They're just new beach resorts, you know, and it's funny because half of them are labeled eco resorts, but they had to completely get rid of this massive wetland to do it. So anyways, it's interesting to see kind of the juxtaposition from very rural, extremely, you know, poor, poverty stricken by our standards in the Amazon being affected by our presence, to right the way around to these countries that could, you know, buy us 15 times over. But you know, the effect of tourism is, you know, there does seem to be a universal tenet, and it's that somebody locally is going to get right on the bandwagon and immediately start taking advantage at all costs. And so it's nice to come across to entities that do try and mitigate and get involved in better long-term planning, long-term thinking, put the brakes on until I can kind of figure out a manageable way to do it without impacting the wildlife. Because you go there and you look at the wildlife and you want to leave money and you want to leave a good imprint. You want to kind of bolster the economy around ecotourism. But at the same time, the downfall is, the way they collate your spending is into general tourism. They don't differentiate that you're trying to leave a smaller carbon footprint. You're not trying to, you're not staying at resort hotels. They don't notice that. They notice that this is part of the income and we're going to dump that right into general tourism. Therefore, we need more hotels, bigger hotels, more theme parks, more. And so it's really hard because I don't know if representation is there quite yet. I mean, the differentiation in the kind of spending that we hope to do and strive to do, I don't know if it's being recognized as a different kind of spending and a different goal than that of the general regular average tourist.
And when, you know, we're trying to, you know, establish ecotourism as sustainable and, you know, the capitalism comes in and makes it inherently unsustainable. Do you think there's kind of a threshold like, you know, you're doing tours in Ecuador. Do you think there's a threshold? Like, you know, how many tour companies can possibly come in there?
I think there is. I think in some places it's probably passed. Mm-hmm. Boy, it's a slippery ground. because you do want, I mean, you want each person that shows up, that money goes towards the foundation. Again, because we're trying, you know, we don't stay at hotels. If a hotel is the only remedy, fine. But it's very rare that we stay outside of, you know, on foundation or you know, on property sites. Regardless, yeah, you are making an impact. Especially, you know, you get into this broader thinking of, you know, how many people going down the trail, how does it affect bird territories, playback, whole other ballgame. And you do, you see its effects. You go to places that, you know, at once, you know, you went there and played a slate crown ant pit and up he popped. And he doesn't anymore. He still calls, but he just sits there in the back because, you know, he's moved his territory away or, you know, something's transpired. It's conjecture. You don't really know what it is, but you can almost guarantee that, you know, there is an impact there. And I guess the question is, it's sort of, you know, how many eggs do you crack to make an omelet for a bad, you know, that sort of analogy. But it's, you know, the as long as, you know, as long as these foundations are buying up large tracts of land, it's almost zoo-esque, I suppose, in that, you know, you're taking a certain portion of the wild population almost not out of circulation, but you're infringing upon it so that the greater population can benefit, or at least you hope, you know, that's the idea. But yeah, specific science is, you know, it's probably still lacking. I mean, that'd be any number of PhDs right there. So,
and so what are your views on, you know, we talked about the impacts on people, but when you're talking about impacts actually on the wildlife and the avian fauna, you know, mm-hmm. what is your view of playback? You know, where is that ethical line for playback?
I think a lot of it is sort of time frame. Recently, for example, I found myself in Ecuador and it was really wet and all the birds were nesting, which, was kind of interesting because it's a little bit of a switch. I mean, it's the general nesting season, but it seemed like everything was kind of moved up a bit. And so I found myself playing less in the sense that, you know, you give a couple toots, whistles, play your playback. If the bird responds immediately, forcefully, and it's a male, then he's probably unpaired and he's defending a territory. But if you start to get female calls or anything funny like that, I just pack up and keep walking, just try and get away from there. And I, you know, I don't like trolling. I tend to just, if I hear something, I'll play for it. If you don't hear it, there's probably a reason why you're not hearing it. It might be on a nest. Something's going on there. So I try and steer clear of that. Usually if you get male display calls, I don't mind playing for it a little bit just to see, to see what's going on there. Cause usually they'll come in. If they're already calling, they're usually territorial. So, or at least again, that's the general science behind it. That's the way it's been published and perceived. So I think that's pretty fair. Again, it's almost on an individual basis. You can kind of feel when you get into the forest, pretty quickly what's going on. I mean, you know, if you go somewhere several times, you know, you can kind of tell when it's nesting season, when certain things are moving through that, that are during migration and everything's calling and whatnot. And I think it's probably, again, you know, the more experience you have somewhere, the safer you are, I'd guess. But again, us as tour guides, you know, sometimes we'll go somewhere and we'll be, you know, playing playback after having been there once, twice, three times. And we don't really know it. We do, but we don't. And so, yeah, that's a tough call. I try to be pretty conservative, but people are paying to see birds. So it's sort of, you know, it's the nature of the beast.
Right. Well, and the other one, you know, you think about, you know, doing playback, but there's also, you know, baiting in animals. And there's angel, what's the Hakotako ant pit, angel.
Angel Paz?
Yeah.
Angel Paz, yeah. That's a phenomenon that has just taken off. I mean, they're doing it everywhere now, Peru, Colombia, everywhere that's got an ant pit, if they've heard about it, they're trying to feed one, you know? And, you know, I wonder about that too, but, you know, you get, there are five generations of giant ampitas that have been hand fed by Angel Paz. They're still there. I don't know what the infraction is, but they haven't left and they're breeding and, you know, they seem to be kind of okay about it. So I don't know. Again, you get into these individual bird personalities, yellow-breasted ampitta, very difficult, mustached ampitta, very difficult, giant ampitta, ochre-breasted ampitta, a lot of these things, they just come right out. The dark-backed wood quail is the same thing. They just, you know, they fall around, wait for the whistles and just run right out. Sometimes a year, other times a year, especially when they're nesting, they don't come at all.
Right.
They'll come and then they'll hoard all these worms and carry them off to the babies when they clutch. But during nesting season incubation, they don't respond whatsoever. So it seems like certain instinctual behaviors are not to be overcome. And that seems like a good thing. You know, maybe it's best because it keeps their profile low. I don't think they want to expose themselves or have a predator follow them back from being hand fed to the nest. But these are the things that you worry about. It's almost when you do nest survey research work too. You know, if you want to set up a camera on a nest of an endangered species, you have to be very careful how you go about it. And you have to have specific training for it because that, you know, that object too close to the nest does attract attention from snakes, mammals, raccoons, possums, whatever, anything you can name it. And so it is, that's another thing. But in the case of Angel Paz specifically, it seems like the ampitas fare really well. He has had a barred forest falcon pick off a couple wood quail. Now, would that normally happen? Yeah, I'd say it probably would happen under normal circumstance anyways. Right. But you never know. That's one of those things that would require a lot of diligent study. But it's so spectacular that it's really hard to put a tangible value on having a giant ampitta after having searched for him for 3 years, 2.5 years, and gotten horribly fleeting views, talking about myself in this instance, of course, come running up the trail, hopping up the trail right at you. Like it's hard to describe. And I think that, you know, that like the U.S. ambassador went to Angel Paz and saw that and sang its praises and started talking about bird conservation and ecotourism and all this kind of stuff. What's that worth?
Right.
It's hard to put a tangible value on the ripple effects that this exposure has. And again, it's sort of that zoo-esque thing. You know, a kid walks into a zoo and before you know, he's, you know, Hannah and, you know, and one of the, or he's at Attenborough, or he's one of these, you know, type of just iconic people that have really brought wildlife and the love of wildlife into the homes of so many people. And so, you know, I think in Angel's case, I personally would give him a pass just because he directly has influenced a lot of people and a lot of thinking. But, you know, again, he has a touch. There's something about him that the birds really like. I mean, you'd like to think that everybody can do that, but I don't think everybody can. You go to Colombia and they have feeders set up where they throw worms and stuff, but they don't come right to your hand and that sort of thing. At least not all of them do. So
I've seen videos of him and it seems to me he has this, you know, this generally soft, almost a sing-songy nature to him.
Absolutely.
That's so non-threatening.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He and his brother Rigo, and you know, and they spent months and months doing this, 8 months to train the first one, and 4 to 5 months on each subsequent species. I mean, it's not, you know, and this is every day. And on top of that, they farm. They have, you know, dairy cows in another plot of land. I mean, they're out from when we show up in the morning so they can show us the birds until, you know, Lord knows when. I mean, they're just hardworking folks, but they really went out of their way to do this because they do. You can tell that they love the birds, and I mean that's why he names them. They're like his family. So
how did he come to know that was a giant ant pit? I mean, did some birder come and say they could be here, or what happened?
Basically, he noticed when he would go walk down in the morning early when he was constructing this pavilion to watch the Cock of the Rock, because he has this fantastic Cock of the Rock lick there too. Which, so it's like. The whole morning there is just, it's just a circus. It's just one amazing thing after the next. But yeah, so he went down to set up this blind by the Cock of the Rock deal, and because people had already been coming, but only to see that. Mm-hmm. And Maria, the giant amputee, the first one they trained, he noticed she was following him down the trail, and she was picking at the trail where he had stepped, because he's kind of, you know, as you walk, you kick up, you turn over leaves, things like this. And so she was sort of following him. And he asked the owner of Bella Vista if anybody was interested in these other big birds that were hopping around the ground that kind of followed him. And so the owner, Richard Parsons, to hear him tell it, he just said, well, I don't know. I don't really know what they are, but, you know, give it a shot. And so, you know, he worked to train this one. And then I think I was there 2 months. The first time I went was 2 months after that giant amputee had been trained. And, you know, everyone was sort of flabbergasted. I think everyone was just like, this is impossible. This is an impossibility, because they're just so skulking and sort of mythical and difficult to see. And, you know, now I went one time and had four species of amputee, one species of ant thrush, the dark-backed wood quail, toucanets, toucan barbets, play-billed mountain toucan, all these things. He had black-chinned mountain tanagers feeding out of his hands, you know.
Oh, wow.
It's just – so it's sort of an interesting thing how that evolved. And he was, sort of the first of his kind. And so some of the other foundations have actually paid him for his training expertise to train some of their park guards how to do it, so they can have a similar attraction to get people to come and continuously come as a source of revenue. Yeah.
So, you know, kind of switching gears, you know, we kind of touched on Oman, and there was somewhere else in the Middle East I saw that you have been to. So what's the attraction, the birding in Oman? Because I have this Lawrence of Arabia, endless sea of sand mental image.
Right, right.
So what is the attraction?
I think the surprising diversity is part of it. But it's also, you know, some of the birding spectacles that you can find there are pretty unique. But again, there is, you know, in the central desert, a lot of people like to go to see gray hypocoleus. You know, it's pretty much the place to see, or one of the two places to see hypocoleus. You go to the Gujarat, you know, Western Ghats in India, and you can maybe find them in the winter, but there's a big wintering population. And there are some that winter right in the courtyard of this one little oasis hotel, and it is an oasis. So there is a lot of sand and bleak, stark, vast expanses around you, camel trains and all sorts of, you know, fun things and true Bedu, you know, Bedouin groups moving around the area that you come across very regularly. But I think the other thing is that the coastline is beautiful. They have mountains that go up over 12,000, 13,000 feet. They receive snow in the winter. And so you have wadis that have, you know, some precipitation. And then wintering and staging grounds there are huge. There are a couple of waste disposal sites where you can, for example, go in the morning and see maybe 12,000 steppe eagles. You can see maybe 60,000 eagles all in eight different species in, you know, basically by standing still. And there's other places where you can go, like Bar Hikman, which is this really big Sabka mud flat area, very shallow, very far. And in one morning you can see, you know, 750,000 shorebirds at two stops. I mean, literally 1 kilometer apart. It's just sort of that they have these massive spectacles. And then it's sort of the, you know, I guess the mystique of traveling from these great high red sand dunes in the border with UAE and Alain. And then you cross in and you skirt the mountains to reach the coast in Oman. And then you go across the central desert going south, and it's just vast and white. And they have hundreds of foot tall golden dunes there too. And then you bird these oases along the way. And it's just, it's sort of spectacular. And you end up in this place called Salalah, which is Africa. It has baobab trees. It has dry thorn forest. It has all these African birds and a lot of Yemeni, Omani endemics. And, but then again, you know, you're walking around, you're birding, there's camels everywhere, and it's, you know, it's just, it's pretty spectacular. And it's a very friendly country. I think, just because the UK and the US have been so influential in the evolution of the Sultanate of Oman, and it's been so recent, you know, we're talking the last three decades, that it's gone from basically third world to, you know, right up there with the UAE as far as conventional technology and sort of cutting edge goes. The UAE being one of the greenest industrial expansions on the planet, I think it's the second greenest industrial expansion on the planet in the last 10 years. So it's just sort of, you know, you land in the UAE and it's like landing on Mars and finding civilization. It's just bizarre and amazing. And the birding is just exciting. You never know what you're going to turn up. This last trip we went on, we had, I guess, four different birds that there were less than 10 records of in the respective countries we found them in each. And, you know, it's just exciting. It's just exciting. We had a first record ever for Tega Flycatcher for Oman. But, yeah, you get a lot of rare birds and special things.
And do you see a birding culture developing there with
– Yeah. It's kind of like birding and photography have come along together. It's crazy because it's so photogenic. Like everything you see since it's open is approachable, except maybe a, you know, McQueen's Buster, right? They can be kind of tough. But everything else, you know, you can get pretty close to. The sand grouse, you just kind of wait at watering holes and they come in. But, you know, a lot of the scenery, since you have these, you know, thousands foot tall mountains diving into a bright blue Indian Ocean and stuff, it's very photogenic. And so a lot of the photographers, they start off as wildlife photographers, have become birders, avid birders. And so there's actually quite a big birding community now. It's expanding and there's, you know, it was started by expats, of course. There are some, you know, pretty important folks from the UK that were down there, and several folks from, you know, Sweden, Switzerland that have, you know, kind of influenced as well. But it's a really neat, exciting place.
Yeah, we talked about the expats in Oman. It goes to my theory. No matter where you go in the world, there's some crazy Australian that's been there for 6 months.
Yes, absolutely. That just went there to just hang out and stayed. Yeah, absolutely.
And you find the attitude towards the West, you know, given the current political culture, it's still, you know, very safe, and the attitude is good towards Westerners?
Very safe. Very good. Yeah, very good. Exceptional. I mean, almost to the point where, you know, sometimes you know, you're there and you can't help feel bad about what our general thinking on their culture is. And, you know, I mean, it's very different. Women work, women drive, they go to school, everybody, you know, you can do whatever you want in these countries. And so it's really just an observance of religion and the extent to which the religion is observed that is more on an individual level. Yes, you've got 5:30 noon, 5:30 calls to prayer. That's throughout, but that's because there's mosques and that's what mosques do.
Right.
And so it's not a theological regime at all, even though it is a sultanate. I mean, it's the sultanate of Oman. You know, it doesn't get any more cut and dry than that. You know, there's one man at the top of the food chain and that's it, and his royal family, but he's done so well by the people. Poverty is almost unheard of. So when you know, I think when the people are happy, everybody's happy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess taking that further, a lot of the, you know, all radical thinking, a lot of radical thinking is born from poverty and sort of, you know, general discomfort and misery. So you have these countries that are very, very doing quite well and providing wealth throughout. They're helping to evenly distribute, educate, and keep healthy even the lower classes of their population. They don't seem to have that much trouble, internal strife or external. You know, people tend to be pretty happy. So
what's their economy based on? Is it an oil economy in Oman still?
Oil economy, tourism is getting right up there. And again, I mentioned sort of some of the downside of that we've seen in the last couple of years, all the expansion of the tourist resorts. But then again, I mean, they have, you know, two or three of the biggest sea turtle rehab and breeding centers in the Eastern Hemisphere, right there on the peninsula. One of them is at Ras Jinns. That's a cool place. So they, you know, I think tourism's definitely second. It's huge. Dates are another one. They grow top flight dates, and then frankincense, some of which I snuck home with me for Christmas. They actually have, you know, the original frankincense that was touted historically around the globe to various personages and being sold or traded. There's only two places where you can get silver quality frankincense, and Southern Oman and far northern Yemen is one of them, and not too many people go into Yemen. So,
I have to ask. What the hell is frankincense? I you know, you hear that and you go, oh yeah, frankincense. I have no idea what it is.
It's the sap of a tree, and the tree never grows more than, say, 8 meters tall. So never more than like 30 feet. And they grow extremely slow. And they don't actually exude sap from a cut until they're 80 to 100 plus years old. And so it's not a quickly renewed resource. And they're scattered throughout. They have, you know, wind-borne, or they have to be cut, or they have to have a flood that takes branches and deposits them to re-root. And so frankincense trees are not very prolific. And they're pretty spectacular kind of to behold. But yeah, it's the sap. On the sunny side of the tree, the side of the tree that gets the afternoon sun, if you cut there, it'll come out and it becomes rock hard, and then you burn it and it gives off a really, really nice, powerful fragrance. And that's where all the incense, the whole incense culture came from this sap that people would burn. You just, you know, have a little coal, have a piece of foil on it, put the frankincense on top, light the coal, and it kind of smolders it down. And yeah, that's it.
Well, now I know. I was really, really wondering about that. So, you know, you've been in Montana now for a little while. Did you have any link with Montana before you moved here, or was it just going to Montana?
It was sort of just going to Montana. I mean, I got offered a job here through Rocky Mountain Bird Observatory and the Montana Natural Heritage Program, and it was a wildlife inventory. It's like a pilot year, and so there was a few of us that were hired to run out of state, do point counts, and do the small mammals and birds, this kind of stuff. And I'd been through here twice before in the summer, and I loved it. And I thought, well, hey, I should go up and hang out. I didn't really have any attachments at the time, and by the end of that summer, I had a very strong attachment to Gabrielle Perkins, who I'm now married to. We just got married a few weeks ago.
And I've seen her walk back and forth in the background a couple of times.
Yeah. She says hello. So you know, we met, and I'd always had that hankering to go to Alaska and go to the Pribs, and the job had been offered to me a few times. And I thought, well, hey, before it gets too super serious, if I'm going to go away somewhere for 3 months, I better do it now. So I took off that summer, but we had maintained a relationship throughout. And after Alaska, we moved in together, and we've been together ever since.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And, you know, you've been in Montana. So what's your big Montana rarity so far?
I don't think I have one. I haven't chased at all. I did manage Hoary Redpoll was pretty good, I guess. Actually, those are quite fun. I like those. Well, and the circumstance is great because the guy I was birding with actually had a common redpoll land on his head.
Oh, geez.
Right on his head. It was spectacular. And so anyways, we were kind of sifting through. So that was a pretty good one. But I don't know. Wyoming Pacific Loon, Wyoming Scoter, nothing too crazy just yet. But I'm going birding tomorrow with a couple buddies. So hopefully it'll be a brambling.
A brambling.
Like red flank blue tail would be fine.
If there's a brambling, I better get an email. That's all I'm saying.
Will do.
And you know, you've been in Montana, you're still doing these trips. How's the balance going of being away for these trips and the married life now?
Yeah. Well, and I think that was one thing that, you know, we talked a lot about that before, Gabby and I, before we really decided to do this. And I basically promised her a certain amount of time in a year that I would be able to be home and that I wouldn't be gone on long stints at a go. You know, after a couple of weeks, you know, no problem. 3 weeks, it's tough. More than 3 weeks, it's very tough. And so basically, I've sort of split it up to where I'm gone for a couple of weeks and I'm home for quite a few. My deal with Rock Jumper is great. And that was part of my stipulation for taking it, was that I wouldn't be out more than 140 to 150 days max. And the rest of the time I'd just be salaried admin stuff that I can do from home. So it's great because I don't have to report to an office when I'm here. I can just be here. I can, you know, help make dinner. We can go do stuff. Last weekend we went and stayed at a lodge for a couple nights just to kind of get away and stuff like that. So I don't know. Free time is important, and I think that, you know, gosh, most guides, yourself included, I would imagine would say that, you know, relationships are the hard part. Mm-hmm. Balancing that personal and time away is very tough. But I think it takes a good combination and the right person. I got lucky. She's great. She's very independent. She has a lot that she does. And I think that helps too.
Well, that's great. So, you know, you've been, you know, you've done the Latin American thing. You're, what have you missed? I mean, what's the bird that you just, is just that enigma, that one you can't latch on to?
Boy, that's a tough one. You know, for the longest time, it was chestnut-crested Cotinga, but I finally got that in Colombia year before last. I think it's got to be the long-whiskered owlet in northern Peru, because I haven't been this last year, and only about the last year, year and a half, they've got it like tied to a branch. It, you know, people are getting really great looks and photos of it. And I love owls. They're fascinating. I've done some spotted owl work and stuff in the past, and they're great. And I would really love to see that. So hopefully on the next Northern Peru tour, it'll be there, and I'll get to see it. My two previous trips, I heard it, glimpsed it once, didn't really get a satisfying view. So that's my one. That's the big one. That's the
longest, long whiskered owlet. That's
long whiskered owlet. Yeah,
that's the top of a lot of people's list.
Yep.
And so as you have these tours and you keep expanding and you keep finding new places, is there an idea of bringing on guides to kind of backfill for you so you have that time at home? Or
certainly. And that's something where we are too with the expansion. We're actually we've just hired two more guides in the last couple months. We need a third by the end of the summer. And that's if, you know, the two that are sort of, you know, trying out right now and going through the first couple tours, you know, if that all works out, then they'll stay and we'll need at least one more. Office staff too. It's busy. I, you know, it's not a complaint at all. It's a good thing. You know, when there's a lot of work, it's great, but yeah, we're definitely still looking for guides. And, you know, in kind of the, you know, and I think most guys would probably say this, you know, bird knowledge is a big part, but finding a certain people, a certain skill set in managing groups and managing people, in managing logistical hurdles. Like you say, you know, the van gets stuck, the bus breaks down. I was just in Ecuador. The bus died on us, had a group of eight people in the middle of nowhere. I go to the nearest farmhouse, get them to take me into town, had to hire the only three commercial trucks in town to get us the rest of the way back to the airport, this kind of thing, you know. But it's sort of like being able to, I guess, you know, there's a definite distinct skill set. So we're looking for more people. So,
oh, great. Yeah. So, let's see, we talked about Montana. We talked about this, but what we didn't talk about is what was the beer you're having tonight?
Oh, okay. Well, I normally don't do too much on Hefeweizen, but I always have a couple Paulaners in there, especially for jambalaya night. We do a pretty mean batch of jambalaya.
There you go.
So, and this is the stuff to go with it. So I put a little bit of brown ale in the jambalaya, but I always think this tastes great with it. So
there you go. Well, Forrest, thank you so much for being a guest on More Than Birds. And
my pleasure.
Can't wait to hear more about your tours and how things are going for you.
Well, thank you so much, and I hope to run into you soon.
Definitely. All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks again.